Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 194 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Just remember that you will be responsible for any long-distance charges. Also remember that I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message. Let me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it, or what you don't. If you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you'd like to sponsor this show, please contact me. You can make a one-time donation via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com or monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. That's PATREON. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my show, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending the show to your friends. You may notice that some of the audio in this episode and the following couple of episodes is not quite up to snuff. I've been on the road, so didn't have my normal audio recording equipment with me. If you'd like to help me purchase better equipment and help with my travel costs so I can see more people in different places, please consider donating. One upcoming episode you'll find out in a couple of weeks could not have been made remotely over the phone as I normally do. I'm interested in topics that are a conundrum. Two desirable goals in conflict. Both cannot be achieved. In a perfect world, perhaps sex would be something only between two or more, I suppose, loving and consenting adults. And that is a stated goal of most religions and cultures. But the reality is that sex work has coexisted with sex often being purchased by the most enthusiastic purveyors of monogamy. And like alcohol, banning sex work has not worked, and it harms the providers of sex for hire, who are often seen as the victims. Some people want to continue the war on sex work, but only against the customers. But imagine if we made the purchase of donuts illegal, but the baking and selling of them legal. I don't think the donut shops would be happy to see their customers arrested and their ability to sell their products destroyed. This interview also asks whether sex workers are always victims, or at least in some cases, happy and fulfilled by the work. Andrea Werhoon is a writer, performer, and former sex worker. She is the co-creator and author of Modern Horror, a memoir, a collection of short stories and photography in collaboration with filmmaker Nicole Bazouin. She holds an undergraduate degree from the University of Toronto with a major in English and a minor in religion and paradigms and archetypes. She's been interviewed by the New York Times, The Guardian, The Daily Mail, Vice, CBC, Hazlitt, and now The Infectious Myth. She's currently writing about sex and consent for Playboy.com. She's also involved with the Toronto Sex Workers Action Project. Welcome to the show, Andrea.
I heard about you when I was reading an article on the decline of strip clubs in Canada. It used to be a big, powerful institution, and I guess some people are glad that they're disappearing and other people are not. You have a history of working in the sex industry and then supporting workers in the industry, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that. Like, how did you get involved, and, you know, what were your attitudes before, during, and after your time?
Well, it's funny. It feels like things have come full circle as far as being interviewed for the Globe and Mail piece about the demise of strip clubs, because it was in a strip club that I felt I had my conversion experience to sex work, because I'd never been to a strip club before. I was in university. I was probably about 20 years old. Mm-hmm. And I'd heard the same old things that everybody else hears about strip clubs, that the women hate their jobs, they want to die, they all have dead eyes, they're not interested in being there, they'd rather be doing anything else.
Right.
And worse. So I went and I discovered that the women were, you know, happy, dancing to music that they loved. They were beautiful, naked women dancing on the stage. And to me, there was something a little bit more deep and profound to all of this than what I'd heard.
Right. I mean, I don't mean to interrupt you, but it would be very simple to say, you know, everybody in the sex industry hates their job and they're just there because they were trafficked, because they were forced to be in it. But I think life is more complicated than that. Not that I'm an expert, but I think that's where you're going.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very simplistic to assume that an entire workforce hates their jobs. You know, if someone is going to go as far as to assume that sex work is work, which is, of course, what I advocate for. But yes, it's far more nuanced and complex than that. I mean, if you did a survey of any working population, I find probably most people hate their jobs. So
at some times, I
became entranced.
At least at some times. I think in every job, there are things people like, things people hate, and things people tolerate. Right? It's a job, so it's not always perfect.
Absolutely. I think it's a greater symptom of existing within a capitalist society that we have to work. And so we find the jobs that are relatively well-suited for us do the trick. We're all surviving. We have to figure out some way to survive in this society. So for some people, sex work is the option because it's fairly open-ended. You don't need to have that high of an education. You can have a criminal record. It's hard as hell to get a job when you have a criminal record. And various other things that make it appealing. But for myself and why I chose to enter, after that first experience at the strip club, I became obsessed. I felt like I had discovered this whole world, and everything people had told me about it was wrong. And I endeavored to find out the truth for myself. And I started wanting to become a stripper, and I talked to a few people about it, and surprisingly, people that I knew and trusted were saying things to me like, well, why don't you consider becoming an escort instead? It's better paying, it's private, you know, at a strip club, anybody can walk into the club, and being from Toronto, if I work in a Toronto club, who knows, they'll show up, high school principals, et cetera.
Yes.
And you're protected by a driver. So I mulled it over for a very long time and eventually decided to call an escort agency and started working with them. And I was going from, you know, being a 21-year-old who had up until that point basically only made minimum wage to making $160 an hour. So I was feeling pretty high on life at that point. And
right.
I mean, for the most part, I really enjoyed it.
Right. So my understanding of the escort business was that you paid the escort agency for access to a woman to be an escort, and then other services were charged by that woman to the man, such as sex. Is that the way it works?
No.
Okay.
It's sex. It's straight up sex. It's I mean, you buy by the hour.
Right.
What the agency does. So the agency that I worked for charged $260 an hour. Mm-hmm. And then basically what they did was book my appointments, advertise for me, send a driver to pick me up and drop me off.
Right.
And who also served as my bodyguard if necessary.
Right.
And for those services, basically as an independent contractor employed by their agency, that's what I was giving up $100 of my hourly rate for. But yes, it was very explicitly sex. It wasn't going to events or anything.
I just was thinking that, you know, I used to see advertisements for escort agencies and they never advertised sex, but everybody knew that that's what it was providing, right? It was one of those things that nobody had to state what the actual service was. Did you run into some customers who were particularly bad?
Sure. Yeah.
And you needed your bodyguard in that case, you know, to.
It never that bad,
mm-hmm.
but it's hard to know when you're a novice and you're just starting out when is the right time to call for protection.
Right.
It's hard to know, and you know, outside of sex work scenarios, when to call for help, when you're in a dangerous situation. You know, sometimes it's too late and you feel like it's untenable to pull out a phone and call the driver, you know. I did experience rape while I was on the job, but only once or twice.
Mm-hmm.
Statistically pretty good, considering the amount of sex I was having.
And there are other jobs that are relatively innocuous, such as working in a corner store or working at a gas station, that also on occasion have danger, right? Like if you're
Absolutely.
Working alone in a corner store, you're pretty vulnerable if somebody comes in to steal or for whatever reason. And obviously there's been people who've been killed at gas stations when somebody drives in and takes off without paying, and the person at the gas station is going to end up paying for the loss of revenue. So there are lots of jobs that have danger. Even policemen or whatever could face danger. But the protection is pretty important, and in some sex work there is no protection. Like a woman on the street by herself might not necessarily have somebody to protect them.
Well, and it's interesting because now that I work for MAGIS, the Toronto Sex Workers Action Project, I have a lot of experience interacting with street-based sex workers who, because they can't rely on police protection, I mean, no sex worker can rely on police protection, unfortunately, thanks to the effects of criminalization,
right.
They develop protections within their own community. They have buddy systems. They write down the license plate that their friend, you know, they hop into a car, friend takes down the license plate. There are organizations like the Bad Date Coalition in Toronto that are focused explicitly on distributing monthly materials on who bad dates are,
right.
What they look like, what they've done. And so these are ways that the community steps in when we can't rely on law enforcement to protect us.
And when we talk about the Nordic model, which is promoted by some people, it basically says we're going to criminalize the purchase of sexual services, but we're not going to criminalize the sex workers. Would that help?
No. No,
okay.
It doesn't help because it perpetuates the idea that, for one thing, all sex workers are victims from the start. And
mm-hmm.
that all Johns, all people who, all their customers, the people that are paying their wages, essentially, are perpetrators of violence. It fundamentally assumes that all sex work is violence. And that's not the case. Most clients of sex workers are good people. They are everyday people that we come into contact with. They are not bad people. But yes, it is an industry that does attract predators because it exists within this dark gray zone of the law.
Yes. I mean, I've read that, you know, every sex worker is an abused woman. And you're saying that's not always the case. I mean, is it sometimes the case? Have you experienced women who are being abused by their pimp or in some other way being abused as part of their sex work?
It seems like we go back to, like, you know, it's a bit of a more nuanced, complex picture than that, because, you know, if you want to talk about pimping, there's no girl around who's talking about her pimp. They don't call these guys pimps. They call
mm-hmm.
them their boyfriend.
Right.
It's their boyfriend. And, you know, like, then you're getting into, like, relationship stuff. And yes, it may be that he expects her to go out and make some money to pay rent, and he may chip in a certain way, but, you know, as far as, like, how much abuse plays a role in the life of the average sex worker, it's a very, like, difficult question, because I can't help but think about how abuse plays a role in the lives of every single one of us, and we all have, you know, brushes at least with abusive interactions with superiors at work and abusive relationships. And so I know that it's the stereotype that all sex workers are victims of abuse in some capacity, but it's just a little bit more nuanced than that.
Right. Well, I think with any work, there are people who love their job, they're compensated well, you know, one end of the spectrum, and then there are workers who are abused, right? Their employer steals their money, maybe yells at them, maybe there's some physical abuse. There may be nothing sexual about it at all, but they're still abused workers, and they hate their job and they're under stress all the time. I guess in any area, there's going to be a spectrum of those things.
Yeah, and I think what makes sex work different from those jobs is that we're not as readily able to talk about our experiences in public. We can't as readily disclose abuse to others. We can't, you know, so few of us are actually open and out about our experiences. And even for myself, you know, for the most part, I've enjoyed sex work. I feel like it has been a boon for my life. It's rewarded me in so many ways. But I exist within this society that shames sex workers and stigmatizes sex workers. And even I feel, you know, a latent level of shame as a result of just, you know, thousands of years of prejudice against, you know, independently sexual women. So it's just really hard to talk about these issues.
Well, I think as a Western society, we have this ideal that sex and love are things that should be equated, that sex should never be sold, and that monogamy is the ideal. But even if you go outside the area of sex work, that ideal is not that often found. I mean, there's lots of people who are cheating on their partner, who've had, you know, many, many partners over a period of time. There are people who marry for economic reasons. I think of Melania Trump, probably not marrying for love or for sex, but for other reasons. So this sort of ideal is used to, I think, sometimes say, you're not meeting the ideal, but then so is nobody else, hardly.
Yeah, no, the ideal doesn't make any sense. And like you alluded to, I think a lot of people would, if they considered the facts, would see marriage as a form of prostitution when it comes down to it. And I mean, just on the topic of marriage, like it was my job to have sex with married men and, you know, ask me if I'd like to get married. I have no faith in the institution as something that is upheld with any real honesty in our society. I think the institution is corrupt. So monogamy, it's a funny joke to me in a lot of ways when you consider who is upholding rules, who follows the rules, and who makes the laws, you know? I find all this stuff very interesting.
So why are men going outside their marriage for sex? In your opinion, have they told you why they want to go to a sex worker rather than within their marriage, like they're supposed to limit themselves?
Well, I've had it put to me in a few different ways. One guy put it in a fairly succinct way that he feels like he could tell his wife and she would understand, or he could tell his wife and she could leave with 50% of everything he owns. Right. So he'd rather not tell her. He'd rather continue this stable marriage, you know, especially as you get older, you have kids, you don't want a divorce just because you have a libido. And I agree with that. Sure. I don't think having sex outside the marriage should necessarily be grounds for divorce. But I do think if you're lying to your partner about your desires, it belies a stronger issue with the core that needs to be addressed. So I think the other thing too is that we live in a society that is essentially built around the pleasures of men. It's not built around the pleasures of women.
I was going to ask you that because, you know, men have, there's female prostitutes, there's strip clubs, those are for men. There's also male prostitutes who service also men. Like, what provides for the sexual satisfaction of women? Good
question.
okay.
Wouldn't I like to know?
I mean, there's some male strippers, but that's pretty small, a pretty small item.
Yeah, I think society is changing, and I think women's desire and sexual identities are developing in such a way that we are starting to prioritize our pleasure over male pleasure, essentially. And I do see a future in which women pay for sex, because I don't think there's anything morally questionable about paying for sex. If it's what you want and it's what you need, and there are people who are happy to offer that service to you for a fee, go for it. But I think there won't be a time where women are buying sex as much as men until two things happen. One, women need to be paid equally to men. Right now, there's, still an economic disparity between men and women. Women don't have as ready access to a disposable income they can use on their own pleasure. We just don't have that. And secondly, we need to learn how to prioritize our pleasure, because we're taught from birth that it's important to please men over ourselves and to
Do
make
you
men comfortable and to make men feel good.
I think a lot of men would say, well, if a woman wants to have sex, she just needs to go to a bar and become available, and she can find a man and get the sex for free, right? Because there's always men. But I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of women for which that is not an option, right? That they could not moral they, it's not moral, but they psychologically they could not go to a bar and entice a man to come back to their apartment. It's just not something they would want to do or feel safe doing.
Right. And also, the type of man, or not even man, anybody, that she needs to know what it is that she's looking for. She needs to have spent the time working on herself and thinking that her own pleasure and her own desires, to know, like, the guy that she can easily pick up at the bar is not the guy that she wants, or the kind of sex that she wants. She may want something very, very, very particular, and that's where a sex worker can come in and give that to her in a very specific, targeted way.
I interviewed an American sex worker a few months ago, and she was talking about actually doing some couples therapy. And she didn't get into a lot of details about what this is, but there's a lot of couples that have sexual problems. And maybe it could result in a man going outside the marriage to have sex and the woman just being unfulfilled. But maybe a sex worker has having more experience could actually help them, be better be a better monogamous couple if they're
Totally,
open
totally.
if they're open to that.
Yeah, and I just think what relationships need at their core, no matter who's involved, is honesty. You just need people to be honest with each other about what they want and what they're not getting and where they think they can get it, and working collaboratively to figure out solutions to maintain a solid bond. And sometimes sex workers are a perfect solution to that problem, because they can provide exactly what it is that the couple is looking for in a no strings attached way.
I mean, it seems okay to talk about sex therapy, right? If a couple goes for counseling, but we sort of pretend there's this big wall between sexual therapy and sex work. Like maybe if the sex worker is physically involved with the couple as opposed to sitting there and talking to them. But maybe maybe it's better to actually have, if we can break this bound that monogamy is the only, it's really a self-deceit that monogamy has to be maintained or society will collapse. And of course we can look at lots of powerful men who use women as disposable commodities. That's a tradition that goes back thousands of years.
And they do that whether they're paying for it or not. That's just the story of womanhood.
Yes. I mean, powerful men have always had easy access to women, I mean, it's not entirely the men taking the women. It's a little bit more complicated than that. Like Monica Lewinsky, for example, offered herself to Bill Clinton. Like she was starstruck, I guess, by his political power and charm. So what are some of the particular Canadian issues you're dealing with? Like, my understanding of Canada is that prostitution is kind of in a legal vacuum right now, or selling sex work, that the Supreme Court has overturned laws about it, but there is a period of time where the government can try to write new legislation.
Right. So this issue of whether the current prostitution laws made it dangerous for sex workers to do their jobs, that was considered unconstitutional by former Supreme Court Justice Beverly McLaughlin a few years ago, back when Stephen Harper was in power. So
Right.
basically what was ruled was with three specific laws were considered unconstitutional for putting people's lives in danger, which was keeping a common body house. So basically sex workers could not work together in the same place
Right.
without that being against the law, which, you know, looking at it objectively seems absurd because you would think that being able to work together would make their jobs safer, which is why it was overturned. The communication law as well.
So it'd be
So
like
communicating to the.
advertising your services, like on Backpage or some of these other, is that what they're talking about?
I think it was more public solicitation that they took issue with, but I would need to double check that. So that was, I believe that was the law that was most commonly used in like cracking down on prostitutes, and it was unfairly targeting street workers. So
Right.
I'm pretty sure it wasn't applied to the advertisements. It was applied to women in the street soliciting people
So if
right
a
then and there.
policeman undercover goes up to a woman and says, "I want sex, how much is it?" and she answers, then he arrests her, right? So how have are women still being arrested by police in the absence of these laws? Like, what has changed?
Oh, so what happened was there was that law, those two laws, and then there was also the living off the avails of prostitution law. So basically, these were declared by Beverly McLaughlin as being unconstitutional, and then Stephen Harper responded by saying, well, we don't care. We are going to maintain these laws and make them even stricter. And introduce the Nordic model into Canadian politics. So now we exist within a system where sex workers are considered victims and are technically not supposed to be punished for being sex workers. And it is the John or the client that is criminalized. However, we're still seeing so many more sex workers just be arrested
And
and
what for
criminalized.
what excuse? What are they being arrested for if this supposedly
The
has
same
changed?
laws like solicitation and like under that living off avails clause, like family can be arrested. It's really scary.
A family can be
Like friends,
arrested.
yeah, people who live in the house with a sex worker can be found criminally living off the avails of prostitution.
So if a woman brings money home and has a kid or an elderly mother at home, then those would be supposedly participating in this criminalized enterprise.
Technically speaking, I mean, you would hope that the cops wouldn't be so heartless as to charge a granny or a child with these things, but stranger things have
Right.
been seen.
Yeah, that's probably not a good example, but I think I understand what you're saying. Like, anybody who's taking money from somebody who's earning money from prostitution, I guess it's supposed to be targeted. It's what I call the pimp, right? A man who's your bodyguard or whatever is definitely living off the avails of sex work, right? So that was supposed to try to get rid of them.
Right.
But I'm very suspicious about wars on something. Like we have the war on drugs, which has been spectacularly backfired spectacularly, and we have the war on a lot of things, and there's been a war on prostitution for centuries, and I would say that sex work hasn't really declined in that period of time, but a lot of people have spent a
Absolutely
lot of
not.
time in jail and probably working under more dangerous conditions. Like, what would you like to see, in terms of balancing, people obviously don't want to see people soliciting sex outside a high school or something like that. What would be your balance where sex workers could work safely, that their work could be accepted by society or at least tolerated, and they, how should things change in your opinion?
Well, I advocate for the decriminalization of sex work. So, starting on a legal level, making it not criminal to be a sex worker while maintaining laws against violence against sex workers, like rape and assault and theft and kidnapping, keeping all of those illegal so that sex workers can actually rely on the protection of law enforcement, and so it's possible to catch perpetrators of violence.
Right, like
Also,
you'd want to be able to dial 911 if
yeah,
a client starts to beat you up or whatever,
yes, it would be
active,
nice to rely on the cops and not feel like, if I'm in a situation where I've been raped by a client and I call the cops and I go to the station, there's a higher risk that I will be arrested and not the perpetrator of the crime. So that needs to change, and that will come with the decriminalization of sex work. And once we're there, we can see sex workers work. We can see more people coming out of the shadows saying, I'm a sex worker, this is what I do. There's so much stigma around this. Hopefully be able to establish unions. That would be really cool. I mean, it's a labor force, we're talking thousands of people in Canada, North America, like hundreds of thousands of people who are in this industry. And we're a force. A lot of us on the higher tiered levels have money. We have money to support the people that are at the bottom. So yeah, it'd be nice to be a little bit more open about that. I think internet advertising is really important, and allowing people to continue to advertise themselves online, because it's been proven that since the advent of online advertising for sex work services, it keeps women so much safer. It keeps them off the street. It allows them to screen their clients. It allows them to communicate with other sex workers so that they know that they're not seeing somebody who is bad, who has a history of violence, which is something that's currently being challenged in the United States after the passing of SESTA-FOSTA, which has basically obliterated these online communities of sex workers. Again, when we don't have the support of law enforcement, we have to work to keep each other safe, and we need to be able to communicate with each other. And what SESTA-FOSTA did in the States is basically eliminate these channels of communication with other sex workers, and that is going to cause more violence against sex workers.
I think one of the delusions is of people who think that seem to think that sex work could be eliminated, just like people
Right.
thought that drinking alcohol could be eliminated or consuming drugs could be eliminated. One of the delusions is if you close off advertising, then the problem goes away. There will be no more sex
Yeah,
work,
no.
but that's that doesn't make any sense. That what's going to happen is people are going to find other ways to sell their services, and you're saying that's more dangerous. Like, why is it more dangerous if you don't have access to an online advertising service?
It just, like, I totally agree with you. I mean, it just forces people to go into darker and darker recesses
Like
of
on the
the
street or.
internet. Or it's on the street. And then back to the point about the Nordic model and, if the law is criminalizing clients don't want to get caught. You're not getting rid of clients. Like, people are always going to want to pay for sex, and they will look for further and further secretive ways of contacting sex workers and put pressure on sex. We've already seen that reported in Canada, that women are reporting that they have to meet people in more remote places. They have to make split second decisions when they meet somebody. And also because if the client is at risk of being criminalized, then that means that she's likely losing money, which means that she needs to make a living and she needs to take more risks to make her living.
Right. I understand. So it's not like they can go about, sex workers can go about their daily life unchanged, because they have to adapt to the needs of their client,
yes.
Which is the need of the client is, I don't want to get arrested. I don't want my name in the newspaper. I don't want my family knowing about this.
Exactly.
There's a lot of talk about sex trafficking, and to some extent I can understand that, like, if you put a bunch of Mexican women in a van, take them across the border, and you keep them in a motel room and you sell their services, that's trafficking. But it seems to be very widely used for things that are hard to see as sex trafficking. I mean, have you seen a lot of talk about this, and how do you see sex trafficking defined?
Well, I certainly don't doubt that human trafficking and sex trafficking exists. And like you said, you know, putting a few women in a truck and going across the border potentially to facilitate prostitution in some regard would be considered human trafficking. Even if every single woman in that car has agreed and is excited and is like, I'm going to make a ton of money and then go back, you know, home across the border and be able to, like, give my family a nice vacation. I've heard stories like that. I've heard stories of people, going across the border for sex work jobs, and they are incredibly risky.
And sometimes the women do get exploited. Like, they find that when they get to where they're going, the work is different, that they're expected to service a lot more clients than they thought, and they're not getting that much money. But that seems like it's not the going across the border that's the problem. It's like the workers' rights issue, right? They're not getting their pay. They don't have the right to control how much time they work during the day. They're not allowed freedom of movement, things like that.
Yeah, I totally agree. It is a workers' issue, and part of the vulnerability of being employed within a criminalized industry is that these employers who are exploiters know that workers are not going to call the cops on them. They feel like they're scared. They don't know what's going to happen to them if they try to report something like this happening, not to mention the fact that everybody knows that they were working as a sex worker. So there's just so many layers of intimidation that takes place there. My issue with the conversation about human and sex trafficking is that in the greater dialogue in society, people conflate human and sex trafficking with consensual sex work, which is, of course, not the same thing. And so as a sex worker advocate, I'm, a part of a movement of people that are supporting sex worker rights. We believe victims of human trafficking and sex trafficking, and we value those stories and their experiences, and they are truly horrible things to go through.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the, like, dialogue is concerned, when we talk about sex work and the first thing that comes up is human trafficking. And, like, what about all those kids that are in the slave trade? It's like, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about consensual sex work and the consensual offering of sexual services for money. Like, this is two totally different things.
Right. And, like, if you take a bunch of 14-year-olds and lock them in a motel room and sell sexual services, then you've definitely committed a crime and crossed a lot of moral lines. And I'm sure you're not supporting those people.
No.
and even if a 14-year-old says they want this, they're considered too young to make that decision, which I think is the right decision for society, right? But you're talking about consenting adults over 18 or whatever the age of consent is, depending on where you on where you are. There's similar discussions about pornography that, pornography is maybe not as much as it's not exclusively consumed by men, but is definitely there's more pornography oriented towards men's taste than women. Although I think that maybe is changing more. But I've read that, every woman, every person participating, it's not just women, every person participating in the pornography interest industry is being exploited. But I mean, do you have any thoughts on whether that's basically the same thing as sex work, that some people do it voluntarily and others are exploited?
As an advocate, I would certainly put pornography under the same umbrella as sex work because, the actors, the performers are being paid for sex. The only difference is that there's a camera in the vicinity, and it's being produced for public consumption. But that's the only thing that distinguishes it from regular old prostitution. I think the porn industry is, another subject in which it's a huge industry. There are several attempts to make it an equitable industry. You have lots of companies coming up that are build themselves as alternative, as being equitable, as being fair to their performers. And I feel like we've all heard horror stories from the more conventional mainstream porn producers where women aren't being respected on sets, where they're being paid less and less, where they're expected to do a lot more performing than perhaps they expect, hurting their bodies in lots of ways. I mean, these are just general sex worker issues. But because porn is a bit more mainstream, it's in a way easier to talk about it in as a form of public discourse.
And also it's
But
you're really talking about workers' rights, right? Like the
yeah.
fight for women to have equitable pay. I mean, that's just as true in say banking as in sex work, and the right to work without being physically abused, either because of your working conditions or because because of your boss is a jerk or something. Those rights that are provided by government regulations or unions in some cases, those are normal workers' rights, right? Like those are the
But I will
fights that people have
say,
had for a long time.
though, as like a consumer of pornography, I do think that we are implicit in the exploitation of workers if we do not pay for our porn. And yes, there's a lot of free porn available, but if we're not paying for our porn, that means that the worker is not being paid for their work in a fair way. Do you know what I mean? Like, because there are lots
Right.
of ways to pay for porn, but because of the way the internet works and how accessible free porn is, when we don't pay for porn, we're not paying for the labor of everybody involved in that production. It's like pirating, It is pirating.
Right. I wanted to ask, and maybe a naive question. You said you were raped as a sex worker. What is exactly does that mean? Does that mean that the sexual that the sex was something you didn't want to have, or that it wasn't paid for? Like, how do you define that?
Well, it's always fun detailing
Yeah, I mean, I don't want
the
you to get
details
too
of my rape,
personal.
but I'll tell you. What happened was with this particular client, and I write about it in my book, Modern Whore, a memoir.
Oh, yes, that's what I wanted to mention. You have a book, so you have to mention that you have a book so that people maybe go out and buy it. So that.
that I had so many really wondrous, interesting, fascinating experiences with the men that I got to see. But I did have one or two experiences that crossed the line. And in one particular situation, basically I told the guy I was in pain. He said, "That makes me want to have sex with you harder." And he did, and he held me down. And that was that. So I had about 10 minutes left. I just took it for the 10 minutes. it's like really disturbing to talk
Right.
about this.
No, okay.
But
I appreciate your openness because it's not easy to talk about, and I understand. You contract for a certain service, and if somebody wants to do something you're very uncomfortable with, that's non-consensual at that point, right?
yeah, and that goes back again to one being a woman and just being a woman in general operating in the world and not knowing how to handle rape. And then secondly, like you've said, when you're a worker and you've been contracted for a service and then somebody goes over the line, particularly fraught within a sex work scenario where some people feel that because they've paid you for a service, they should get their money's worth. And if you say no, it doesn't matter because they own you for that hour and that's how they see the
Right,
service,
right.
which is total bull,
Right.
and wrong and very weird. I mean, you don't own your waitress when you're at a restaurant,
Right. Some people seem
like
to
being
think so.
paid. Yes, right. And we see people at restaurants treat frontline service workers like crap, and it's, not different to sex work. It's a service industry job. It's the most
Yeah, I mean,
intimate service industry job.
if you go to a restaurant where women are sexualized, like I guess Hooters was the sort of stereotypical thing, wearing short skirts and tight tops. Some men seem to think that putting their hands on their bum or their breast or whatever is part of what they're paying for. And certainly the environment kind of encourages that method of thinking, but that's not what you're paying for. You're paying for the hamburger.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And
And I would hope that it would reflect in the tip that they appreciate a woman in a tight top and short shorts delivering that hamburger, but that even that's not guaranteed, and I'm sure they're getting paid a server's wage to do it. So you want to talk about exploitation.
I agree. And often, like there was something in Toronto, which is where you're from, where men went to work wearing high heels and things like that, because women are
Right.
forced to work in very uncomfortable clothing in order to
Right.
be more sexually enticing, to bring more people into the restaurant. But I don't think they get paid extra for that, because nobody wants to admit that that's why women have to dress like that, that it
Right.
brings people into the restaurant.
Yeah.
And women are supposed to suffer if they shut up and suffer if they want to keep their job. But I don't want to be too negative. I think you also said that most men seem to know where the lines are. Most of your customers
Yeah.
know what they're paying for, and they're not going to go beyond that.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, most clientele that I've had in my sex work career, albeit, I guess it's, I worked as an escort for 2 years, and I have worked on and off at strip clubs. Most guys know the score. They're not bad guys. They know, in a strip club, they know why they're there. They're there to spend money. They're there to get dry humped. It's all good. I don't know. I have had a vast majority of positive experiences over negative experiences, which
Well,
is
I think
why I
that's
continue to advocate for it.
right. I think that's important to say because there's a lot of focus on the bad things men do, and there clearly are a lot of bad things men do, whether it's a Harvey Weinstein type of sexual harassment of actresses, or men that abuse prostitutes or whatever. There's a lot of bad things, but that doesn't mean that most men don't know how to behave themselves.
Yeah, I think there's it's just sort of wrong. And I will also say for myself, the reason why I do sex work and the reason I advocate for sex workers' rights and for client rights as well is because I love my clients. I love men. I'm not a man hater. I'm here hey, I'm having fun. I hear all the stories. I often wonder about why is it that people have such a vested interest in hearing strictly negative stories about sex work and silencing people who have had positive experiences within the industry. Like if you talk to sex workers themselves, and sex workers are rarely consulted for their own experiences. People like to just talk about us without us. You find lots of sex workers who have had their education paid for by generous clientele, or who have fostered their dreams and allowed them to be more than they were before having entered sex work. And so, you know, I think the thing is, it's not necessarily an empowering job for everyone, and I certainly don't encourage every woman to get into the sex industry, but it is a flexible, well-paying job. You pick your own hours, you can set your own rates, you can do it relatively safely. There is a huge community of sex workers that exists either locally in a lot of towns or in cities and online. It's great.
Would you say that the fact that men go outside of their relationship or they don't have a relationship reflects a lot of hang-ups that society has about sex? I mean, if couples were more open about their sex lives, would they be therefore more happy and not the need to go outside would be less? Or do you think some men just want to have, they want to pay for sex because it's different than if they have a relationship? It's a different type of sex, how you get it, how you, what you do, etc.
Oh, it's such a big question. it's an important question too. I think, you know, this sort of goes back to my waxing poetic about marriage and its obsolescence and how it's not as relevant anymore to maintain these monogamous relationships. I think some people are monogamous, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And there are people who say they're monogamous and pretend that they're monogamous and are not monogamous and lie to their partners about what their true desires are. And I feel like relationships could be so much more healthy if they just opened up and both partners were free to explore outside of the relationship, come back to each other, talk about what they learned, what they liked, what they didn't like. You know, if I speak from my own experience, I had been in a monogamous relationship for years, but I knew I wasn't a monogamous person, and I was a serial cheater, and I cheated a lot until I finally reached a breaking point, and I said to my partner, we're either breaking up or we're breaking open, and I think we should just try it out, because otherwise I can't be in this relationship anymore. I have other desires. So we broke open, and frankly, it took the piss out of the allure of cheating to know that it wasn't against the rules, because I was realizing I kind of just liked doing it because it was bad. Right. And for a lot of people, there's a taboo against it, which makes it attractive. And there's all these sort of issues that get looped in. You know, if someone's existentially unhappy, they think that instead of talking to their partner about their issues, they can just go and talk to an escort about it.
I mean,
bang it out. Maybe that'll make them feel better. And it might for a little while, but it's not addressing the main issue.
But I mean, do you think that there is some of that, that men go because they can communicate more openly with a sex worker than with their partner?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We are. I think that actually is part of why we're so stigmatized and why it's important to keep us silent, is because we actually know people better than they know themselves, better than their partners know them. We know secrets, and we sex workers, you know, wherever there's a powerful man, there's a sex worker behind the scene who knows more, because she's the recipient of his secrets. You know, we're all just sort of lock boxes of truth in a way, and it would be a great threat to our society as it stands to give us any semblance of power.
Have you learned about sex and life and other things from some of your clients?
Yes, for sure. Yeah. And I learn about kindness and generosity and gentleness from them as well. I consider some of them to be my patrons, to be people who support my dreams, people who support my creative vision and my ambitions. They are incredibly kind people that my life would be worse off without them.
I mean, it seems like you could apply the same observations to any job. And if you work in a restaurant, you probably, the large majority of clients are just coming in once to eat, and there's not much there, but some would be very supportive of the restaurant, would become your friends, and others will be total assholes. You
Yeah,
just
for sure, right?
want to get rid of them.
You develop a regular relationship with people that you see often enough, and even if there is some element of a financial exchange there, whether you're, like you said, a waitress or maybe, bartenders who have their regulars that come in every day, every other day, every week, you get updates on their lives. You find out how the kids are doing, how the wife is doing. You develop relationships with people, and that's not to be discounted. And just because sex is involved, you would think because sex is involved, it would be a more intimate relationship. That's something that becomes more akin to a strange life partnership. It's hard to explain, but there is an intimacy there.
Well, we're coming close to the end of the time, so tell us a little bit about your book, Modern Horror.
Modern horror. That's right. Sure. So modern horror is a collection of short stories and photography. I wrote 27 short stories for it. My collaborator, Nicole Bazine, she's a filmmaker. She took over 60 photographs for it, and it's a memoir based on the 2 years I spent working as an escort in Toronto.
Well, thank
It's a
you.
beautiful book.
Okay.
Thank
Well,
you.
yes. Well, I hope a few more people buy the book, and I will send you a link to the podcast when it's available. And thank you for sharing. I'm not saying it's a difficult subject, but it's something that's stigmatized a lot by society. So talking openly about it is not something that happens that often. So I greatly appreciate that, Andrea.
Yeah, thank you so much for the offer, and it was a great conversation.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 194 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.curow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.